In the 12th century, some difficult questions arose in the church.
Now, theologians debated, is it absolutely necessary that God become man to pay for sin? Or is it only hypothetically necessary? That is there no other way God could have done it? Or is this just the way that God chooses to do it?
Theological thought in the 12th century. That's next. Questions like that began popping up in the church. The theologians who discussed and thought about these issues were highly influential, and the conclusions they reach reverberate today. On this edition of Renewing Your Mind, Ligonier Ministries teaching fellow Dr. W. Robert Godfrey returns with his Survey of Church History series. We're sharing all 73 lessons from this series here on the Saturday edition of our program. So far, we've traveled from the apostolic era now into the Middle Ages. The theologians we'll be discussing in this lesson wrestled with critical issues that helped shape Christian thought for centuries. Let's join Dr. Godfrey now in the classroom.
Well, at the end of our last lecture, we had just begun to look at the rise of the phenomenon of scholasticism as a theological enterprise, and I was trying to make the difficult argument that scholasticism is really important and really valuable and shouldn't be dismissed as an entirely negative movement. In fact, it was a great effort on the part of great minds in the Middle Ages to wrestle with the question, what is the relationship of faith and reason? It's a question the church, in a sense, has always wrestled with, that we're still wrestling with. What are the uses of reason? How far can human reason take us? What resources does reason need to be reliable? And how does reason relate to faith? Is reason the foundation of faith? Is faith the foundation of reason and its proper uses? Or is it a more complicated relationship than that? And that's part of what scholasticism set out to investigate, to reflect on. And in our wondrous century, although only by a little bit, one of the great theologians of the Middle Ages arose, probably the greatest theologian since Augustine, and that is Anselm. Anselm was a remarkable figure. He was a very distinguished churchman and able administrator. He served for a time as Archbishop of Canterbury in England. He got involved in the investiture controversy. You remember the conflict between church and state over who was actually in control, and was exiled a couple of times from his episcopal office. But we remember him today preeminently because of his great theological work, the ability with which he was able to use the mind to reflect on theological questions. He lived from 1033 to 1109, so he just sort of snuck over into our century, but he did a lot of his great work near our century and is really quite foundational to it. Even in his own day, he was sometimes called a second Augustine. That's how highly regarded he was. He was a very pious man, very devoted to the Virgin Mary, in a variety of ways, therefore, showed himself to be an exemplar in terms of what the Middle Ages was looking for as a great teacher, as a great churchman. But as I say, our interest is primarily in him as a theologian, and he didn't write a lot of works, but the works that he did write were quite significant. And one of the intriguing works he wrote was called the Pros Logium, the Pros Logium. That's an intriguing work because in it, he wrestles with the question, how can we prove the existence of God? And he talks about some of the proofs with which we might be more familiar. This is that reason-faith question. If people don't have faith, can you by reason demonstrate to them that they ought to believe there is a God, that reason shows that there ought to be a God? And Anselm came up with one of the most intriguing arguments for the existence of God that's called the a priori ontological argument. The a priori ontological argument. The argument, as summarized by a non-philosopher, again, if R.C. were here, he could do a much better job of this, but I think I can make it simple. The a priori ontological argument goes like this. If there were a God, in the nature of the case, wouldn't God be at least partially defined as that than which nothing greater can be imagined? I mean, isn't just in the nature of the case that if there is a God, he's got to be the greatest. He's got to be superior to all other things. If there is a God, and there is such a thing as goodness, then he's the most good. If there is a God and there's such a thing as greatness, then he's the most great. If there is a God and he's powerful, he must be most powerful. If there is a God and there's holiness, he must be most holy, right? So God is that than which nothing greater can be conceived. Well, if there is no God, but we can conceive of God, then must it not be that the being than which nothing greater can be conceived must have existence? Because if he doesn't have existence, we could think of something greater. So if you can think of a God who doesn't exist, but God by definition is the being than which nothing greater can be conceived, he must exist. Because existence would be greater than non-existence. Now you're reacting exactly the way everybody reacts. A sort of profound, does that really work or not? And it's intriguing. Some of the greatest thinkers and philosophers in Western history, ever since Anselm, have divided right down the middle as to whether the argument works. Some have said, this is just ridiculous. This is just a mind game. Existence isn't an attribute like every other attribute. And so you can't just add existence and then say you've proved what you wanted to prove. And Anselm would say, well, you know, this isn't like positing there's an island in the Pacific and then just saying because I posited it, I can add existence to it and it must exist. We're talking about the being than which nothing greater can be conceived. And so it really is intriguing how, when you look at the history of philosophy, there are those who say, that doesn't work. And those who say, yeah, you really can't get away from that. I tend to go back and forth. I don't really have a good philosophical mind. So you can ask R.C. sometime whether he thinks this argument works. I think maybe it does. But in any case, Anselm has left philosophers talking at great length over this question of the existence of God and whether his ontological a priori argument works. Clearly, a fascinating theological mind at work. The work of his, though, that gets even more attention is a work entitled Cur Deus Homo. Latin title of the work, which means literally, why God, man? It could be translated, why the God-man? Or more frequently translated, why did God become man? Why God-man? If we are agreed, as the church was agreed, that Jesus is the incarnation of the eternal Logos, become man. If we are agreed, as Chalcedon taught, that Jesus has a complete divine nature that he had from all eternity and a complete human nature that he received in the incarnation, united in the one person, why? Why did God become man? What was the purpose of that? And so this treatise is a treatise not on how God became man, or what did it mean that God became man, or ontologically how do we understand that God became man, but why? What was the purpose of God becoming man? And this really becomes a treatise then on the atonement. Why was it necessary that God become man? It is one of the very profound reflections on the atonement. Like many profound things, when you summarize it briefly, it all seems kind of simple and obvious. And partly it's obvious because we're the inheritors of these profound thinkers that were wrestling with questions that hadn't been so profoundly wrestled with before. And the brief sort of way of talking about what Anselm came to is this: man owed a debt but couldn't pay it. God could pay the debt, but didn't owe it. And only the God-man could both owe the debt and pay it. Now, that's so simple. We're inclined to say, well, an idiot could have thought of that. Well, actually not. It took a lot of careful thought, a lot of careful reflection. And it rests on this notion that sin is a debt that is owed, that sin somehow must be dealt with, that God either cannot or will not — that's another theological debate — God cannot or will not simply overlook sin. Sin is a problem that has to be addressed. Now, theologians debated, is it absolutely necessary that God become man to pay for sin, or is it only hypothetically necessary? That is there no other way God could have done it? Or is this just the way that God chooses to do it? That's a dicey question. Anselm seems to be saying this is necessary. God did not become flesh except because it was necessary. This is the only way we could be saved. This is the way God acted to save sinners lost and helpless in themselves, and the God-man came to do for us what we could not do for ourselves. And so this is a really profound deepening of reflection and thought about the work of Christ, the necessity of the work of Christ. Now, when we were studying ancient church history, I said there, as you all remember vividly, that in the Eastern Church, the focus remains theologically, through its whole history, on Trinity and Christology. Their focus is on the being of God and the being of Jesus. It's in the West, because of the influence of Augustine, that focus becomes much more on redemption, on soteriology, on the meaning of salvation. That's why, in a sense, the great moment in redemptive history for the Eastern Church is the incarnation, God and man united. In the Western Church, the great moment of salvation is the crucifixion, where Jesus pays the penalty of man's sin. And in the great theological work of Anselm, we see a deepening, even beyond what we find in Augustine, of an understanding of the atonement, the importance of the atonement, and the meaning of the atonement. So in Anselm, we have a really early and brilliant and powerful theologian who is advancing the church in thinking carefully about theological issues. Now, we have really many theologians, and we'll not be able to talk about them all, but I want to at least mention another theologian a little bit later than Anselm, by the name of Abelard. Abelard lived from 1079 to 1142, so he gets us a little farther into our wonderful century. Abelard is principally remembered for his love of the beautiful Heloise. Do you remember that story? Here was a cleric who fell in love with a woman and got into a lot of trouble for that, and we won't go into all these sordid medieval details of his loss, but he too was a very thoughtful theologian and wrote something very important in the church in the middle of this wondrous century, a work that was published under the title Sic et Non. One of the curious things in the Latin language is there isn't quite a word for yes. I don't know if that reflects a kind of negative spirit amongst the Romans, but this work is often translated yes and no. A little more literally, it would be thus and no. But yes and no gets the spirit of a little better. What Abelard did is he went back and looked at many, many theologians that had come before him and asked what those theologians thought on a variety of theological issues, and then wrote down key quotations and demonstrated that in the history of the church, on many, many theological issues, there were yeses and nos. There were theologians who said one thing and others who said another. On that particular approach, one might almost say Abelard was a forerunner of the Reformation. What he was saying is tradition does not speak with a single voice. You can't look back at the theology of the church and say the theologians were always saying the same thing. We've already seen that, haven't we, with the issue of the Lord's Supper. There's a yes and a no on the Lord's Supper. We've seen that with the issue of images. There was a yes and a no on the images in the history of the church. And what Abelard wanted to say is we need to be aware that it's not quite so easy always to say what has the church always believed. What is the universal voice of the church? You remember in the ancient church, Vincent of Lerins has said, well, binding tradition is what the church has always said everywhere, and everyone has said it. Well, that's a great ideal. The problem is nothing measures up to that standard. And Abelard, then, in the middle of the 12th century, is illustrating that in his famous work, Sic et Non, which shows that the Middle Ages itself had some sense at the time that this matter of orthodoxy, of the voice of tradition, was more complicated, perhaps, than it was sometimes made out to be. The other thing that Abelard talked about was this matter of atonement. And Abelard became really the extreme opposite of Anselm. And this is important because Anselm and Abelard will represent two poles that have continued to be present in discussions of the atonement pretty much ever since. And Abelard's basic position was there was no necessary debt that had to be paid. That's to misconstrue the nature of God. It's to undermine the love of God. It's to fail to appreciate the love of God. And Abelard said, Jesus didn't become a man to pay a debt that we couldn't pay, but the Logos became a man in order to show us the love of God. And that the death of Christ then on the cross is not primarily a payment. The death of Christ on the cross is primarily a manifestation and an example of the love of God. And that point of view initially often seems very appealing. God isn't someone who needs to be appeased. Isn't that a terrible notion? But God is always loving. God is always caring. And the death of Christ shows that. But the problem is, as Bernard, for example, saw clearly and vigorously attacked Abelard for his teaching, the problem is, how really loving is it for God to take his own son and crucify him just to show that he's loving? If the crucifixion is only to show the love of God, how good an example of the love of God is that just by itself? Now, if the crucifixion has another purpose, as Anselm argued, then it is an act of love because God is doing something that needs to be done and he's doing it out of love. But just to say it's only an expression of love, I think Bernard rightly saw, is really problematic and really undermines the notion of the love of God rather than supporting it. So we begin to see how theological issues arise, how really important they are. And I want to talk just about one more theologian briefly from this period who's really very important, and that's Peter Lombard. Peter Lombard was not the creative theologian that Anselm was. He was not the speculative theologian that Abelard was, but he was a great gatherer of information, a great systematic mind, And he produced what became the fundamental textbook in theology for the later medieval church. Lombard died in 1164, and he wrote a book that was entitled The Four Books of the Sentences, it's usually translated. One of the great problems with Latin is it only gets half translated. The title of the book is the Libri Quatuor Sententiarum, the Four Books of the Sentences. Actually, it means the Four Books of the Opinions. He's gathering, sort of as Abelard did, the opinions of the church, but he's doing it in a more orthodox manner. He's maintaining a kind of unity of witness of the church. And the interesting thing is that Lombard, when he put together the Four Books of the Sentences, about 80% of it, it's been estimated, was taken from Augustine. It showed how much Lombard knew Augustine, how influential Augustine remained. But this book became the basic systematic theology textbook for the whole rest of the Middle Ages. Lombard was known as the master of the sentences. And the first thing that you did as a theological student thereafter was to master the sentences. And everything that was written theologically was written in dialogue with Lombard. So this is the fundamental systematic theology text that continued to guide education, to direct education in the Middle Ages, and in relation to which all later theology relates. Again, it's not the most creative work, but it's a great summary work. It's a great bringing together. It's a great foundation from which other scholars would be able to work. And as was the case in the Middle Ages, one of the questions around which he danced was the question of predestination. Predestination was still being debated. And Augustine still had strong supporters and followers who held entirely to the Augustinian decree and notion of predestination. Peter Lombard is very largely Augustinian and presents that in his work, but there's a kind of waffling, maybe. It's Lombard who first comes up with a declaration about the death of Christ. Did Christ die for the elect alone, or did he die for all? And it's Lombard who came up with a great formula: Christ died sufficiently for the whole world, but efficiently for the elect alone. There's a kind of nice, maybe in-between statement, where you don't have to come down hard on one side or the other. So Lombard was kind of brilliant in that way, bringing together the issues, bringing together material, and laying a foundation from which other scholars would build and develop thereafter. So as we come to the conclusion of this lecture, we see how there's a whole new vitality emerging in the theological life of the church. It'll be worked out in much more detail later, but here is a profound beginning and a very creative impetus coming into the life of the church as people are thinking, how does theology teach us about God? How does theology lead us on to God? How does theology help us understand what God is all about?
Well, we've probably all experienced it. Days or weeks after an experience, we realize that we didn't think it through completely, and new questions or conclusions arise. And through the centuries of church history, that's exactly what happened, as we're seeing here. The passage of time has allowed us to think more thoroughly about God. Thanks for listening to Renewing Your Mind. I'm Lee Webb. We continue Dr. Robert Godfrey's series on church history. It's interesting to see these 12th century theologians ponder these deep theological questions. It's also interesting to see how these schools of thought remain influential. Studying church history is helpful as we navigate our own Bible study and interact with others. If you'd like this entire series, we'll send you the 12 DVD set, 73 lessons in all, for your gift of any amount today. Make your request at renewingyourmind.org, or you can call us at 800-435-4343. Anselm said, "I'm not trying, O Lord, to penetrate thy loftiness, for I cannot begin to match my understanding with it. But I desire in some measure to understand thy truth." That's a great summary of the theologians we've been studying. That's also a good thought to keep in mind as we dive into our own Bible study. It shows us why studying church history is so helpful. For your gift of Idiomout today, we will send you this 12 DVD set. Our number is 800-435-4343, or you can give your gift and make your request online at renewingyourmind.org. It's our desire here at Ligonier Ministries to equip believers to be knowledgeable and articulate Christians. One way we're doing that is through RefNet, our 24-hour internet radio station. You can tune in anytime at refnet.fm. There you'll hear pastors, teachers, and theologians all faithfully teaching God's Word. You'll also hear news segments, audiobooks, music, and more. Again, the website is refnet.fm, or you can download the free RefNet app. Next weekend, Dr. Godfrey continues our study of the Middle Ages. One of the major issues of the era was the question of the Pope's authority. In the 14th and 15th centuries, the power of the papacy rose and fell, but always adapted to the times. Join us next Saturday for Renewing Your Mind.